You know when your customers are shopping at your business and they pick up a product? The customer holds it, feels it, and shows it to their friend. Then they look at the price tag.
Oh my, I need to look at something else.
The customer picks up a second item and loves the way it looks. They've heard of this product, but haven't yet seen it in person.
I've got to have this!
You're happy the customer chose to buy a product, but you're equally frustrated that they didn't buy both items.
I want them both.
The Consumer Experience Lab at Barbera Solutions designs behavioral strategies that target the consumer's decision-making process. BarberaSolutions.com. Because the opposite of rational is not irrational. BarberaSolutions.com. Why is the shopping cart always in the top right of the screen?
How do companies predict my purchases?
Why do prices end in 9?
Why do fast food companies use red and yellow in their logos?
Why do restaurants always have one expensive menu item?
Researchers, marketers, and very curious people seek the answers for how we make decisions and how we choose products. ClickSuasion finds the secrets that companies use and shares them with you.
Why do I feel better when I bought the last remaining airline ticket?
How do I make choices based on colors and fonts?
Welcome to ClickSuasion. This is your host, Michael Barbera. Today's guest is James Hunt. James is a professor of marketing at UNC Wilmington's Cameron School of Business. James holds an undergraduate degree in business at High Point University, an MBA from Vanderbilt University, and a PhD in marketing from Florida State University. James has published over 50 articles in the areas of consumer behavior and promotion. He has been at UNCW since 1990 and has received multiple teaching awards. Believing that we are what we consume, James is a self-described barbecue sandwich chased with a cold beer at a ball game. He enjoys hiking to waterfalls, taking naps, climbing lighthouses, and playing drums with crisp cymbals. James, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, it sounds just like me. I might not be the cold beer right now. I might be a little more caffeine.
Well, I'll ask you a tough question to answer.
Okay.
Eastern Carolina barbecue or Western Carolina barbecue?
Man, if you force me to pick one, I'll go Eastern.
Okay.
However, I will acknowledge that I also lived in Florida and in Texas, and they have their unique styles of barbecue, as well as, you know, the Piedmont and western part of our state, and I like them all. I never turn down barbecue. So
it's difficult for me to turn down too, but you have to be careful because there's a segment of the population who might disagree that Florida is a member of the South.
Well, this was in Tallahassee. That's North Florida, which is basically South Georgia. So I think maybe north of I-10 still going to count. So
I once had a colleague get mad at me. So a colleague resides in Fort Lauderdale, and I referred to Fort Lauderdale as Southern Florida opposed to South Florida. It's the last time I made that mistake.
Yeah, I know what you mean. Know it.
James, tell us more about your history, your research interests, and how you found your way into consumer behavior.
Okay. Well, I guess it's a lifelong journey in a sense. I grew up in an education family. Both my parents worked at a local college. And so I was always, I guess, intellectually curious. And I'd say even in middle school and high school, I knew I liked things like psychology. I liked watching television advertisements and trying to figure out how they were trying to motivate people. And so when I went to college, I knew I wanted something related to business. I wasn't sure if it was going to be management or marketing, but it was going to be something, you know, related to behavior, whether it was consumer behavior or organizational behavior. Hadn't quite figured that out yet. But I guess along the way, probably by the end of my MBA program, I knew that the marketing side of that was really what interested me. And when I got to Florida State and was working on my PhD, quickly got interested with a group of faculty there that were looking at emotions, emotional response to advertising. It was applied psychology. You know, it was psychology applied to a marketing situation. So I guess I kind of stumbled into it, but it was a long journey. It's been a fun one.
And then you have a significant interest in fear. Tell us a little more about this.
Okay. Well, it started with just an interest in emotional advertising. And so I guess to start that story, we know that there are lots of ads, whether they use humor or fear or sex appeals or, you know, anticipation or nostalgia or friendship. You know, they're trying to make some connection with the consumer. And so my dissertation and a few papers that were related to that were looking at experiential emotion. It wasn't enough just to have an ad that the marketer thought was emotional, that they actually had to have the consumer experience that emotion, you know, for it to really resonate with them, for the ad to have recall and maybe affect purchase down the road. So my interest really started with all the emotional stuff. But then my first real teaching job was at Baylor University. And I guess as often happens, you know, you find yourself interested in things some of your colleagues are. A good friend who was there, Jeff Tanner, had a specific interest in fear appeal research. And so he kind of is the one that got me engaged in that. And it's been a 20-year journey, I guess, in fear appeal literature. And let's talk a little bit about what, you know, when we say fear, what are we talking about? You know, it's, it could be social fear. You know, ads like, an ad for a toothpaste, a tooth whitener, people make fun of you if you don't have a pretty smile, or people make fun of you if you have dandruff, or, you know, Dr. Scholl's odor eaters, you don't want your feet to stink, or, Dial soap, aren't you glad you use Dial, don't you wish everybody did, you know, those have some humor in them, but they're actually, you know, the motive is fear, a fear of not having friends or fear of being made fun of. So you have sort of that social fear. And then I guess you've got the physical fear, which would be more of the social and health campaigns that try to convince somebody to, you know, don't drink and drive or wear a seatbelt, stop smoking, practice safe sex, say no to drugs. You know, those are all trying to get you to behave in a certain way or to adopt certain behaviors, and they use fear to motivate you to do that. And then there's other kinds of fear that would be, you know, maybe Mitchell and Tires trying to use fear to get you to purchase a new set of tires, you know, because your family is riding on these tires. We see lots of ads for, you know, home security systems with burglars breaking into the house and threatening the family. And so those engage a lot of fear as well. So there's financial fear, right? A lot of the ads for financial investors, insurance companies are using kind of a financial loss fear appeal. So it covers all of that.
Okay. It's funny
go ahead.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, I didn't know where to go next. So, yeah, if you got a comment, this is a great time.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny that you mentioned home security systems. So I recall somewhere in the mid to late 2000s, Saturday Night Live did a spoof on a home security company's commercial because the way that the company was targeting the fear of the consumer, maybe somewhat a loss aversion. Where is that fine line between a good amount of fear to entice the consumer to make a decision and too much fear where you may push people away?
Yeah, that's a really good point. When you look at the long history of research on fear and threat, we know that there's sort of an inverted U-shaped curve when you look at fear versus persuasion. So if you just do a little bit of fear, it's not enough to persuade anybody. It maybe doesn't even get their attention, you know? And then as you do more fear, it gets them involved. It certainly, you know, you recognize that there's a threat. But as you just mentioned, it's possible to have too much fear evoked, and it causes people to just screen out the message and turn it off, tune it out. An example, there's an ad I remember for a pest control company, and they show in slow motion on your television, you see this giant cockroach crawling along this table with this scary music kind of behind it. And then it crawls across a fork and a knife and a spoon. And I don't know what happens after that. But by the time the roach gets to the cutlery, anybody who's really averse to bugs has left the room. I imagine. And the next time that ad comes on television, they're going to immediately change the channel or leave the room. They're never going to watch it again. So for that particular person, I think that they've gone from the top of that inverted U down the other side now, which is where they're losing persuasion. So, and I think the only way you can really find out where that is to test it. I think that's where marketing research comes in. And it's going to be a different point for different people. So you may have several different segments. You know, we started with the home security. You may have one version of that ad that's aimed at younger couples. You may have another version aimed at maybe the next stage where they have, say, maybe they have teenagers. You're going to have a different version that's aimed at the elderly. And it's not just who you're showing in the ad, but the amount of fear that you evoke. You know, you may find that those three different groups have different levels of fear that they can kind of deal with. And if you go too far, you're just going to cause them to tune it out. But I think you've got to do the research, Mike. I wish there was an answer. Here's how much you do, but it's going to be different for different situations, different audiences, different products and services.
Are there industries that use fear in their marketing campaigns more than other industries? And if so, what are they?
With the ones that would come to mind first would be medical, healthcare, I mentioned tires earlier. Some of those tire ads focus on performance, but some of them focus on here's what goes wrong. If this goes wrong, here's what bad things could happen. I think the quick answer is medical healthcare, probably more than anything, and the home security, without a doubt. The home security one's almost always, with the exception, the ones we get here in North Carolina that have some of the Carolina Panthers players and coaches. I guess it's Luke Kuechly in particular that's been kind of a spokesperson for one of those companies. And they throw in some friendliness and some humor. And it's almost like they focus more on the security that you'll feel if you have this system as opposed to the fear you'll have if you don't. Which is another good point. You know, you have a choice. You can focus on the problem, or you can focus on the solution, right? And if you focus on the problem, you're gonna have more fear.
Well, that's actually a good point. How do you feel that adding a spokesperson, someone say a local sports player, might have an effect on, or maybe a humanizing effect on the ad campaign, where it reduces some of the fear, but more so where the individual can relate not only to the product but also to the person in the commercial?
Yeah, I think that's a perfect situation if you've got the right celebrity. Now, of course, that brings us into a whole other area where you have to think about, all right, is this celebrity a perceived expert in any way? Are they a good fit for the product? Are they likable? And do we see them as trustworthy? And, of course, that changes over time. So, you and I can both think of examples of celebrities that were hot and then they made a mistake of some kind and, boom, suddenly all their endorsements are leaving them. But, I think that's one reason celebrities work is not just because they get our attention, but for many of them, there's that idea that, you know, they're even though they're a celebrity, you know, they're like me or they care about me, or, you know, this is a football player on my local team, so they care about us, which may not be true, but, you know.
Are there any industries that you would quickly say, no, don't use any kind of fear appeal in marketing?
Well, I'd say don't use any. You know, while I'm thinking about it, I'm coming up with more that do. politics, how many politician ads are fear of the other guy, right? religion maybe can use fear to try to get more members. That was the first one I thought of was the religion when you said is there one that shouldn't use it. But then I'm realizing it, well, you know, they can talk about here's the awesome stuff that happens if you join our group, but here's the terrible things that happen if you don't. And so they've been using fear for years and years and generations, I guess, as well as the positive. So I can't think of one right offhand, no, where I'd say no you may have one in mind that you're getting ready to mention, but
I don't.
No, fear gets your attention. Fear gets you motivated. Fear leads to action. I think it makes perfect sense. And ethically, as long as you're being real about it, I mean, don't make up a threat. That would be the taboo, right? Don't make up a threat that's not real to try to get people to buy your product. Go ahead.
I think that would cross maybe an authentic or ethic line, or a yeah. line in the sand. Yeah. Whereas I think the consumer would be able to identify that and probably understand that you're not being truthful with them.
Yeah, we would hope so.
Hope so, yes, hope so. I'm sure I've been fooled by a marketer once or two in my life.
Of course, yeah. And then when we talk about some of those healthcare campaigns, you know, stop smoking or just say no to drugs, I think some audiences felt, even though you and I would believe that the ads were being truthful, some audiences probably felt that they were not being truthful and that they were overstating what the actual threat was. And so that was probably just telling themselves what they wanted to hear, but it kind of gave themselves permission to screen out and not pay attention. It was like, well, that's not true. That many people don't die from this, or I don't know anybody that's died from this problem.
You know, it's common for us to see commercials, billboards, advertisements in many different places that show, you know, ads for anti-smoking ads. And they'll show mm-hmm. an individual who had X amount of surgeries or has now yep. X amount of disabilities because of what happened because of smoking. To what extent do you feel those are effective?
Well, you can look globally at those and realize that in probably the rest of the world, and I guess I'm more familiar with the ads in Australia and in the UK, where the warnings and the messages are much more gruesome than they are here, and so in those countries they've found that it's been effective. But in our history, and you know, whether it's something about the American mindset, I'm not sure, but and some of the anti-drug ads, the same thing. They've not been very effective. Because I think people feel like, you know, they don't like being told what to do. You know, maybe there's something American there. You know, I'm independent and I can make up my own mind and I don't like being told what to do. And it's one thing for you to tell me what the threat is, but it's another thing for you to show me these gruesome images. I feel like you're trying to manipulate me. So I think they've been very mixed. I think the anti-drug ads, I think, over the years have been a dismal failure. The tobacco ads perhaps more effective as of late. But we know that the Just Say No to Drugs campaign, it just didn't work.
When do you feel – so if you and I were to go to a local store right now and buy a pack of cigarettes, there's more than likely probably going to be a Surgeon General's warning on that pack of cigarettes. Yeah. And that same warning will be in other places, and there'll more than likely be ads for anti-smoking on our way to or from. How many ads, or what do you think is going to be the point where all these ads for anti-smoking or to – prevent the behavior becomes noise in the marketplace?
I think it's already noise in the marketplace. For people who already, let's say if you're already a smoker, you probably don't even notice the ad, right? I mean, the warning on the package, I doubt that you would see it at all. Perhaps it's a deterrent for somebody, I don't know. I mean, I think somebody buying their first pack of cigarettes or something, maybe they see it and notice it. But for somebody that's already decided that they want to smoke, I think they're going to completely ignore it. So it's going to be more of a message that you're going to have to get in other ways, whether it's through schools, churches, parents, you know, peer groups. But I doubt there's going to be too much effect from the packaging. Now, maybe some of the television commercials that are done in a way that's real and honest maybe get somebody's attention. But I don't think the packaging is going to make an effect on it.
If you had data to support these two following courses of action, which do you feel might be best suited to move forward to avoid being noise? Increase the amount of fear appeal or move away from fear and try something different?
It would be hard to increase the fear any more than it's already there. So I think what I would do, which I'm kind of throwing a different answer at you, not completely picking one of your two options, Mike, but rather than increasing the threat, and so I'm making a distinction here where the fear is the emotional response, and that comes from a threat. So rather than increasing the threat, I need to do a better job, I think, of convincing that person about the probability of occurrence. Because we know when we're talking about fear appeals or designing an advertisement or designing a health brochure or a campaign to get somebody to wear seatbelts, that it's not just here are the terrible things that could happen to you. You might die. The bigger issue seems to be convincing a person that what the chances are that this terrible outcome could happen. So I think we can do a better case of educating on here actually are the number of people that are killed in car accidents because they didn't wear a seatbelt. Here is the probability that you will get lung cancer if you smoke cigarettes. I mean, people already know what the negative outcome could be, but it's just easy to dismiss it because they don't realize what the true probability of occurrence might be. So maybe that's the place really to focus, or one of the places to focus on is that probability.
Since you didn't choose one of my answers, I can't accept that.
I understand. Yeah, I know you're a hard guy to deal with. That's what I've been told.
I try.
I know you're just going to edit all that out anyway.
You're listening to ClickSuasion. We're here with James Hunt. We're going to take a quick break. We need to pay some bills.
You always want to look your best, but you don't always have time to deal with a necktie that won't cooperate. That's where we come in. Introducing the Never Tie, the only necktie that you never have to tie. Each Never Tie comes with a tie and two removable knots that you simply slide on and adjust for your comfort, giving you the perfect look every time. Choose from over 20 stylish designs at thenevertie.com.
Welcome back to ClickSuasion. This is your host, Michael Barbera. Thanks for joining us. Today's guest, James Hunt. We're discussing fear-based decision-making, and most recently we're discussing a little bit of loss aversion and how fear is used for anti-smoking ads and similar government warning labels. James, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, thank you, Mike.
What are some, for-profit entities that use fear? Now, we discussed healthcare, we discussed home security, and a few others. What are some other for-profit entities you feel that are?
Yeah, so maybe we've mentioned a few. Yes, so we mentioned what insurance, financial companies, home security, automobile. Whether you're selling tires, whether you're selling car batteries. A lot of the daily cosmetic toiletry companies, I would say, for teeth brightening systems, makeup, cosmetics, soaps, all of those kinds of products are going to have some level of fear behind them. If you watch much TV, and I really don't, but a lot of the kind of the infomercials I see are focused on fear. If I don't eat right, this is going to happen. So buy this particular nutritional supplement or this type of blender or subscribe to this service or Weight Watchers or whatever it might be related to diet. I think a lot of that is there's clearly a positive side too. They focus on here's how good your life can be if you use the product or service. But I think it's fear that gets your attention. You don't want to feel bad. You don't want to look bad. You don't want to have people making fun of you. That's what gets my attention and gets me maybe involved into the ad. And then by the end of it, they've switched the focus from fear to positive, which I think is a pretty good strategy.
Yeah, you know, I'm sitting here laughing inside because you mentioned hygiene and hygienic products. And as I understand the importance of marketing, especially to gain consumers from competitors, et cetera, I often joke and say, why do toilet paper companies advertise? Who is not buying it?
Yeah. I don't think they can sell more.
Yes.
So they're just, they're just trying to steal market share from somebody else. But that's quite a battle. It's going to be hard to increase usage.
What do you think are some of the effects on consumer loyalty messages framed with fear may have on consumer loyalty?
Yeah. Well, here's the way I would look at that. If I have a problem, and I'm looking for a way to solve that problem, and I see an ad or I read a brochure that uses fear to get my attention and make me aware of how big my problem is and I better do something about it. And then they propose a solution. It's a product or a service, and I purchase it and I try it and it works. It removes the threat and hopefully removes the fear both. So next time I have that same problem, I'm going to go back and buy that same product again, right? I mean, that'd just be what? Operant conditioning. I have a stimulus. It's a problem. A proposed solution. I use it. It works. And so there's that reinforcement that links that product and the problem together. So if the problem is surrounded in fear and then this product or service takes it away, that's going to build loyalty. Is the other side, or maybe this is where you were going, that people would get negative about the fear and would want to switch to another company that's more positive?
Possibly. I don't think I know the answer. What do you believe?
I mean, I can see that with a political candidate. Maybe that candidate's just so negative, and all they talk about is problems and problems and problems, and all they do is slam the other candidate, And hey, and here's this other one, and they're positive, and they talk about how good our life can be, and they talk about what they can do. I just like that positive approach better. So, maybe in a political sense, the positive approach would be different and meaningful, but. For our everyday stuff, we don't have to count all our problems, Mike, because you and I together probably have millions of them, right? And some of them are really small, and we ignore them because you can't deal with all the problems we have. So when do you act? You act when a problem is big enough that you got to deal with it. And so the use of that fear appeal is to help trigger that thought, that cognition that, hey, I need to do something about it now. I do need to buy new tires. I do need to buy a home security system. I don't think people mind that. I think they feel that problem is real. They buy the product. It works. It removes the fear. Now they feel great about the product. There's not a negative association tied to it anymore because it has solved the problem.
James, what's next for you? What is next on your list to research? Or if you were to have unlimited resources, what would you choose to research?
Unlimited? Yeah, I'd be researching consumer behavior on a Caribbean island, I suppose, and comparing how people do things differently there. I'm fortunate. I've been at UNC Wilmington for 27 years, so though I still have a need to do research, I'm a little more free to work on things I want to, let's say. And I get a real kick out of working with some of our undergraduates, especially the ones who are honor students, and kind of see them through some pretty, pretty awesome research projects. I'm also lucky enough to be involved with some international programs here and can do some of the trips with our students, some of our study abroad, summer abroad programs. So really in the future, it's already started to happen for me, is I'm getting students that have an interest in marketing and consumer behavior, but they also have an interest in international and global. And so, you know, we're working on projects that might compare the way people process information in one country versus another, or the way women are portrayed in Turkey versus Germany versus the U.S., which is one study a student did recently. So I'm not just making that one up. But, you know, so the future, I think, is more projects that involve students and somehow tie my passion for consumer behavior in with international stuff. And that's really fun and exciting for me.
I would think that's fun and exciting, too. I'll come along with you.
Yeah, come on over.
James, thanks so much for being a guest today on the show.
You're welcome,
it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks for having me. Anytime.
If any listeners want to get in contact with you, how could they reach you?
Okay. The best way is just shoot me an email. And again, I'm at the University of North Carolina, Wilmington. So my email is huntj@uncw.edu. And that'll get me.
Perfect. James, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And listeners, thanks for listening. Go ahead and subscribe to ClickSuasion on iTunes, Google Play, or ClickSuasion.com, and we'll let you know when the next episode is available.
Thanks for listening to ClickSuasion. Subscribe to the podcast, read our research, and get in touch with us at ClickSuasion.com. You can also find us on Twitter with the handle @ClickSuasion.